This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection.
Welcome to a special edition of Coffee House Shots, Spectator's daily politics podcast. Yesterday, Peter O'Bourne set the world alight with an article where he said that he was changing his position on Brexit. He used to back it, but various things have led him to change his mind. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I also changed my mind over the years, but the other way, from remain to leave. But given how much I tend to agree with Peter on, I'm interested to find out why he changed his mind, if I'm the one who's blinkered, and whether the situation really does call for a fundamental reassessment of not just what we think about Brexit, but what the country thinks about Brexit. Peter, it's great to be with you today. Can you say a bit about how you changed your mind? Were there any points in this journey? Was there a day where you woke up and saw a news development and thought, this is fundamentally different to how I imagined it would be?
Yeah, there were several sort of punches to the solar plexus. On the economic one, it was symbolic more than anything else, but it was when James Dyson, he was the sort of poster boy of Brexit, this great industrialist who said it was okay to Brexit, good to Brexit, and when he suddenly announced that he was upping sticks and going to Singapore, it was like a punch to the solar plexus to me. And then Jim Radcliffe, the great chemicals industrialist, evacuates Britain more recently. And that was at a moment when suddenly the head offices of so many major international companies start to quit Britain. You know, Panasonic, Sony, Honda closes its plant in Swindon, the news coming from the northeast. You suddenly started to wonder whether the economic model set out by the Brexiteers maybe was an absolute falsehood, as I believe it is. Further back, Trump. I think behind Brexit lay the idea of a benign international order, where the WTO was something where you could trade within WTO rules. I think the rise of Xi in China and Trump in the United States, you can see a menacing, ominous world of protectionist zones, where the WTO is as effective as the United Nations is today. You know, meaningless, worthy resolutions which can't actually be effective. And I felt that the WTO model, which relied, you know, the great geniuses of the Brexit economic model, Minford, Bootle and people like that, I just don't think it's there anymore for us.
And when you decided to back Brexit, everybody's got their own reasons for backing Brexit or Remain. And some people think about economics first, our country's going to be richer, or I'm going to back it because the country's going to be poorer. I mean, for me, I personally didn't place much emphasis on the economic argument. I thought it would be a wash either way. I thought you could list the top 10 things holding Britain back and the EU wouldn't be in any of them, in my view. I thought it was about something more fundamental, that globalism had overreached.
Yep.
And that what we were seeing in Britain, in Europe, in America, was a kind of rebellion against globalism overreaching. And then the question is, how does government respond to that? Do you say, no, you refuse next year, basically xenophobes and racists, and we're not going to accommodate you? Or do you respond? And I saw in Brexit our responding, mainly free movement of workers. Now, I'm all in favour of mass immigration. I confess to being guilty of every liberal metropolitan cliche. I'm, you know, married to a Swede, I speak a foreign language at home. I'm very comfortable in this globalised world, but I have to work out that lots of people aren't. And if the liberal order is going to be maintained, if we're going to avoid the rise of populism, something has to give. And Brexit, to me, has been that form of democratic adjustment, where the government says, OK, free movement of people, and this whole notion of supranational government, that was too much. It's now time to take government closer to the people. And then when it did, we've got something now, and Peter, you talk about the economic news being bad, I see something else being good. I see populism rampant in pretty much every European country you can name, but not here, because this is a democratic realignment. So therefore, even if I agreed with you about the economic direction of this, it wouldn't change my mind, because I think this isn't really about economics. This is about the realignment of democracy. I'm wondering if you saw it that way, or whether you just placed more importance on economics than the democratic aspect of it.
No, actually, I agree with almost everything you've just said there. And for me, the reason I really voted Brexit, the most powerful intellectual reason was then this brilliant article by two political scientists, Katz and Mayer, written in the 1990s. Peter Mayer is died. He's an Irish political scientist, probably on the far left. Well, I don't really know, but it's called The Emergence of the Cartel Politics. And it was about how the European Union had sort of sucked democratic legitimacy out of national politics. And it met in a way which meant that suddenly voting became almost meaningless. And it also removed, so major decisions were taken away from national politicians and placed into the hands of the ECB, in the hands of bureaucrats in Brussels, in the hands of corporations, actually, which could manoeuvre the bureaucrats in Brussels. And I felt this was, that was really why I did it. And I think that's just as legitimate, by the way. What I've wondered whether, though, is that we realise how revolutionary that insight is, because I think the consequences of this democracy, which you are pointing at, are going to be so disruptive. I hadn't understood that it's going to break the United Kingdom. That was the second thing. I think that we hadn't thought deeply enough about the Irish question, the importance of the Good Friday Agreement, the 500-year-old history or more, his tragic history of Britain and Ireland has come back right in front and centre. And when Ireland, or sorry, when, were the Northern Ireland to go, I think Scotland would go a lot long after. Maybe, and so in other words, the new democratic politics will break up the United Kingdom. Maybe we think that's a, maybe you, do you think that's a good thing or just a part of what is going to happen? I don't know.
No, I think it was a tragedy. I've always thought that I would rather live a lifetime in a Labour-run Britain than a day in a fractured,
right,
disunited kingdom. Similarly, I would rather be a member of the Euro than have Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. So when you want to list my hierarchy of concerns, Brexit is you know, by no means at the top. But it was said before the referendum, if people vote for Brexit, the Scots, they're not going to vote for it, so they're going to then leave from the UK. But the polls haven't really shown that. I mean, for Frank, for two reasons. One was that 2 in 5 Scots did vote for Brexit. Now, that's no means a majority. But given that not a single Scottish political leader supported Brexit, that 2 in 5 is bigger than you might think. And also, it is far more of a dangerous risk to break away from the UK when it's outside the EU than when it's inside the EU. EU membership makes accession a lot more manageable. So that's why the SNP did expect a big spike in support for independence, which hasn't really emerged. That's why Nicola Sturgeon had to give up her second referendum plan. So I have not been as concerned about Scottish secession. And I think that the logic of the union actually becomes stronger after Brexit.
Rather than I originally thought.
Now, the Irish question, I agree. I have been absolutely shocked at the language and the bad blood between Britain and Ireland. I never thought I would live to see such tension. Now, the question is this as a result of Brexit or is this simply posturing by Varadkar? You've got to, because before he came along, people thought the Irish question would be relatively easy to solve with enough goodwill. But then you've got a new Taoiseach, he's got Fine Gael on his back. It is politically important for him to position himself in a certain way. I don't think he's a bad man. I don't think he's an anti-British man. I can see why he's doing what he's doing. But it always did strike me that with enough political goodwill, then the Sweden-Norway border, which is, you can drive over without seeing anything, should be pretty much the same as the Northern Ireland border, that it would be fundamentally a technical issue. Now, that might be an underestimation on my part. I might be wrong, but I'm still not quite sure. I'm still not quite sure how much of this tension of a Northern Ireland border is a result of Brexit, inevitable result of Brexit, and how much of it is simply Varadkar making an issue of this simply because he wants to go down in Irish history as being the man who was assertive. I mean, we quite often forget in Britain the Irish history of this. I mean, to actually have Britain as a supplicant and Ireland working out whether to do Britain favours or not is a great reversal to what this was. But I'm not sure if the bad blood is inevitable or how it could lead to the breakup. I think it might lead to the breakup under Theresa May's backstop, because that would...
He could leave it. I mean, the Northern Ireland agreement, he says that there are border controls. You're going to have another poll in due course. It can. That's what it means. Mm. I had an account of the Prime Minister's visit to Northern Ireland back in February, where she came back really shaken. It's not at all certain that the Northern Irish would vote for remaining in the Union. And in which case, well, you're beginning to see something very profound, which is the reversal of 400 years of history and Brexit leading to the end of the United Kingdom. There are democratic reasons to welcome that, but I think that Britain has been, for all of our faults, a great force for good in the world, and it hits me in the solar plexus. Let me ask you a question,
sure,
Fraser. The Spectator has been the voice, in a way, of a particular type of conservative Britain. And I worked for it. I had the real privilege of working as political correspondent about 20 years ago. And ultimately, that was a Burkean conservatism, I think, is a Burkean conservatism, which is a fear of revolution because of what it can unleash.
Yeah.
That's what the revolution... And the question I've found myself asking is whether we ignored, you and me, the whole Spectator tradition, Charles Moore, Dominic Lawson, we ignored the Burkean message that if you start to meddle and set out afresh on new projects, which was what we now realise Brexit was, you creating... The law of unintended consequences, actions, events are going to take over, and you, without meaning to, you've unravelled something very precious. That's the Burkean insight.
I agree. And they were the reasons that the magazine, and I say the magazine rather than me, because they're not the same thing, ended up supporting Brexit, because we regarded it as a restoration of the essential institutions of government. This came down to a fundamental question, which is what leads to national prosperity and happiness and social cohesion. I've always been a great believer in the role of institutions in playing in any government, not just government, but the judiciary, the respect for the common law. And for a long time, such was my europhilia that I didn't really want to believe that the EU was undermining our institutions. And then it started to, and increasingly, you see this in the way it interfered with our law. And the fact that Brexit is so difficult reveals just how much the EU has now ingrained itself in the running of the British government. The fact that we're having to, that there's so many aspects of government to disentangle, show that over these 40 years, it was the act of joining the EU that was the revolution, more than the act of leaving it. The act of joining the EU was actually changing the basis of our country in ways that we didn't realise, and Europhiles like me just didn't want to admit. And the whistle on this was blown eventually, not by politicians, but by the public. And to me, it was a choice. Either you will try to readjust and to restore the British institutions, to basically have things as they've been in the Burkean way for generations, or you end up with the kind of populism that we see abroad. And you can argue that we owe Nigel Farage a great debt for seeing off Nick Griffin, but I never took it for granted that Britain was immune to this kind of far-right activism. And I saw this as a way of heading it off. So in other words, I completely agree with your premise. I completely agree with that sort of conservatism, but I saw Brexit as being the way of restoring these institutions rather than the revolutionary act. And the fact that it's so difficult underlines the fact that the EU was far more ingrained than even I had thought a couple of years ago.
Yeah, of course, you can put it the other way. And one of the things which, particularly since the 23rd of June, is the attacks by Brexiteers on institutions, the attacks on the rule of law, the judges, the attacks on the civil service. You very kindly allowed me to write a defence of Ollie Robbins. I hated the way that he was being attacked, and the civil servants. Yeah. The institutions of the British state have come under sustained, the Bank of England, sustained and savage attack by the Brexiteers.
By some Brexiteers. I think it's important there are Jacobite elements of them. I would certainly give you that. But you've had Tory party members behaving like revolutionaries and radicals. I will give you that.
The language of vassal state, supplicant, all of this language, which,
yeah,
I mean,
I hate it as well.
The leader of our movement, in a way, conservative, is, I think, probably Fraser and I would both agree, is Charles Moore. He was the creator, in many ways, of the modern Spectator after Alexander Chancellor, the biographer of Margaret Thatcher, the greatest conservative peacetime prime minister. And reading Charles is fascinating to follow the trajectory of Charles from being a Burkean conservative to a revolutionary. He uses these terms of vassal state. I find myself parting company from him. I find myself frightened suddenly by what he writes.
Yes, I certainly remember back in the day when I was a Remainer talking to Charles about this. And I remember Charles saying, well, that the establishment won't let us get away with this and we've got to overturn them. And it seemed strange to me to hear him talking in those terms. I've also noticed a whole bunch of people, only Brexit can have hereditary peers talking as if they are the revolutionaries overturning the establishment. It's been,
landowner, Dorset landowners is another one I've noticed.
Yeah, and it's
Northumbrian landowners, yes.
Yeah, now I think Charles is perfectly coherent in this, but there are others who struck me as if they've just enjoyed playing the insurgent for a while, that after a whole life of being teased and criticised for being the Tory squirocracy, they now get to play the role of the revolutionary and talk about the establishment being somebody else, and it is quite fun. Now, Brexit inflames opinions. You'll always get people using various degrees of language. You get that on the other side as well. You know, the Spectator allows for a broad spectrum of opinion, but I've banned the word Remoner from the Spectator because I thought this was pejorative, and in a way I didn't want the magazine to follow social media down to the tribalism where one bunch of hardcore campaigners will attack the other core hardcore on the opposite side, and that becomes a proxy for the debate. But there's no denying that on both sides you're going to get one side talking about a vassal state, the other side talking as if the whole Brexit movement is just Jacob Rees-Mogg and Steve Baker.
It's certainly true. The Spectator, for instance, you've run Matthew Paris all the way through. I think you've been admirable in the way you've taken voices from.
Yeah. Well, we could do with more of them. And I have to say that as an editor, when Brexit came along, I was sort of shocked in two ways. One, to find myself giving up my lifelong Europhilia, which I still mourn, by the way. I still see Brexit as a sort of personal tragedy for me that it had to come to this. But the other thing was when it came along, so many of our writers were on the Brexit side. The Spectator, as you know, always likes to have a variety of comment. And all of a sudden, what was a relatively well-balanced magazine became one where almost everybody was behind Brexit. So you need to find Remainers. And so Matthew Paris has been very heroically defending that field. And we could do with more of these voices. You don't read The Spectator to be lectured to. And by the way, we didn't back Brexit until the very last issue before we had to. That was partly because I knew that at least a third of our readers are Remain, perhaps more than that. And secondly, because when The Spectator backed Brexit in the mid-70s, we did so in this very politicised way, and the magazine almost died. I think we lost something like 80% of our circulation. Because if you can get what Anderson called enthusiasms, the sort of strong political partisanship, all of a sudden you can start to take sides and to become Praetorian, a partisan magazine. And the same is true for commentators. You can, before you know it, start to advocate positions very, very strongly that you just didn't hold or didn't believe 3 or 4 years ago. And before Brexit, I don't think I wrote a single column about the EU. It just wasn't a concern of mine. And I have to ask myself, as you've been asking yourself, do we as columnists get so embattled? Do we get so conditioned to be taking attacks from the other side, to be responding, that we end up in positions that we would otherwise not have come? And I imagine, Peter, that must have been part of you, because you're, it's very rare, right, for columnists to change their mind, isn't it? And that is probably a defect in what columnists do, because the facts do change.
That's right. I wonder, part of my change of mind is wondering what's happened to the conservative tradition. Mm. And so, you can actually trace the modern conservative tradition through The Spectator. So if you do go back to 1975, when the last referendum was held, it was a manufacturer called Crichton who owned The Spectator. And he, as you say, he'd driven down, even the kind of music reviews were infected by anti-European animus. And he'd driven down the readership to 11,000.
Yeah.
And then we get this wonderful moment when we really ought to honour these great people.
L.G. Clough came along.
L.G. Clough comes along. Mm. And, of course, the appointment of Alexander Chancellor, who's a pro-European, I think. And he gets rid of all of this ideological nonsense and turns it into what Boris Johnson used to call it, a journal of manners, is how Boris used to define The Spectator when he was editor.
Alexander said he wanted it to be a cocktail party, not a political party.
Yes, that's right. And then you get, you know, the great Charles Moore was a superlative editor of The Spectator. It creates a new sensibility, I think. Makes, which is almost unknown, conservatism fashionable, creates the intellectual, uses The Spectator to create the intellectual environment where Thatcher can succeed and win her arguments. And we, The Spectator, get used to coming on at public discourse from very unpopular minority positions and making points which again and again win against the establishment. The Thatcher revolution was argued against the establishment. And then the European argument starts to get made against the establishment. Again and again, the Euro argument we won over the Euro. And I just wonder whether we've just gone too far.
Yeah, well, the Euro, The Spectator was the only publication opposing the ERM membership. Dominic Lawson was the only editor against it, the only publication backing Thatcher at the first ballot. When it's got a sort of great tradition of being isolated and yet correct historically. Now, here, of course, there was no isolation. In 75, it was just The Spectator and The Morning Star who backed
And the
Brexit.
Dundee Courier was the
Oh,
third.
Right, I have been missing them out of my history. There are three publications, where this time it was, you know, there had been a lot more to that. But still, the picture changes a lot. And right now, I have to find myself thinking, right, given that I was borderline, I was a Remainer until Cameron's renegotiation, and I can see all the reasons for Remain because I feel them myself. I would probably be a bit more enthusiastic about the European project than you, Peter. I've noticed that in your article you didn't have that much good to say about it. I mean, I would say that the idea of an ever closer union of peoples is a beautiful and worthwhile goal. I would describe myself as a European. I'm not sure if you would. So for me, there's an element of European identity which is fundamentally attractive. And there is the idea of a comity of European nations is something which I find very emotionally attractive. And I'm wondering if I do so more than you.
I think so. But yes, you say you are half, you're married to a Swede, aren't you?
Yes, the European ideal is a very real one in my household. My wife herself is the daughter of Czech asylum seekers who fled the Soviets. And the idea that my father-in-law is living with me right now can have the same right of residence to go back to his birthplace, a place where he would have been arrested had he returned there in the 1980s. To me, that's a beautiful creation. That those purple passports are things which I'm very much in favour of. And that is what I've had to say goodbye to. And I think in that aspect, I am more Europhilic than you.
Yeah, and does it scare you that we may have made a fundamentally disastrous decision?
I don't think it's disastrous, and I think it's a matter of balance. That people like me, with my orientation, being in favour of mass immigration, that sure, the rules since the late 90s have worked in my favour, but too much so. It's now, and where my big change of mind has come is I've had to work out that what I regarded was the future and the good for everybody was, to be honest, good for me and people like me. And it wasn't so good for others. And that, as a Democrat, you have to make concessions.
I agree about this. Of course, there were winners and losers from whether it was Europe or whether it was what others might call the neoliberal settlement, which has nothing to do much with Europe.
Hmm.
On the other hand, it's sort of starting to dawn on us that the biggest losers are not going to be the hated metropolitan elite. They're going to be the people who voted for Brexit in many ways. If the car firms lose, leave the northeast, and it looks like they, as night follows day, they're going to do it. The threats from the Japanese, which were made so vociferously ahead of the euro debate, we don't join the euro, we're off, and then they did nothing. Maybe you can see now, you can see, this is the point, in the 2 years which has happened since we voted for Brexit, we can see the consequences of it. This is why I changed my mind.
Well, this is one of the biggest differences between us now, I think. It's not so much on... and also, how one sees the present is generally shaded by your overall position on it. So in your article, you say that you read the financial news and you feel anxious, you feel sick to see all of these things happening. Now, I look at the financial news and I see it differently. I see a country that's never had more people in employment, where wages are growing at the fastest rate in 10 years. And then it gets down to the very interesting politicization of financial news. You and I were both financial reporters. So say a car plant doesn't quite close, it's halting its expansion up there in the northeast. Why is that? Now, you would say this is basically to do with Brexit, the chickens are coming home to roost. Others might say that as well. I would say something differently. The whole car industry is going through convulsions right now, that the internal combustion engine is being replaced by the electric car, and that car plants are closing down all over Europe. And if you want to see why the Japanese are withdrawing from European manufacturing, then you can point to the free trade deal that the EU did with Japan. All of a sudden, if they can send their cars tariff-free to Europe, they don't need to make them in the EU anymore. If anything, the fate of the Japanese car plants in Britain is a warning against the free trade that people like me would be advocating, because the benefits might be shared, but the pain is very intense. I actually believed that after the referendum, there was going to be a far bigger economic hit than there was. With Treasury told us there'd be 500,000 jobs lost there, and I thought that was a bit excessive, but there would be something. And it turns out, no, there were 750,000 jobs created. So
but I mean, it does strike me that the record levels of employment we have today have happened within the European Union. And we leave in a day or two's time, perhaps, or a bit later on. You know, that's when we got to assess the economic outlook. And I'm saying that actually, although we've had growth, we're having massive fall in foreign investment has already started to happen.
Yeah. Well, if we were to crash out, so we're talking here on Tuesday, we're due to leave the EU on Friday. If that were to happen, sterling would fall by 10% on Saturday. If I was a foreign investor, I would wait for sterling to fall before coming in, so I can see why they're doing it. But when I look at the present, at the financial news now, I can't see what you see. I can't see much negative effect of Brexit. I can see people delaying decisions. But when I look at our economic growth, I see them on a par with France and Germany even this year. But I'm also aware that, am I seeing this because I'm biased? Am I seeing this because as a committed Brexiteer, I'm now likely to minimise anything and come up with all sorts of different excuses for it? It's difficult to rationalise why you think of things in a certain way. But I never really thought Brexit would be economic help, and I don't think Brexit would be economic hindrance either. I think the reason that we've got lots of jobs is because of the reforms the coalition government made, of welfare reforms, of other things. So I don't think economically it's going to be a factor. But then again, that is part, if you talk to anybody who backs Remain, they will put economic things quite up there. Talking to somebody who backs Brexit, you'd be hard-pushed to find people who really think it's going to be a boom. Most Brexit people think, yes, there'll be an economic price, but it will be worth paying. And a lot of those people, by the way, are so relatively poor that they don't really think that things can get much worse for them. So I've never... One of the lessons of the Scottish independence campaign was that economic determinism only goes so far. You can tell the Scots, don't vote for independence, there's going to be a recession, you're going to be a lot worse off. A lot of people don't see it that way. They don't see it as a financial equation. And so that's why my mind hasn't been changed by the economic picture, because I haven't really seen it changing in a way that you have seen it changing. And I guess it's difficult to disentangle from both of us, you know, how much of this is because of our change of mind. But what I can't work out is, do you think there should be a second referendum now, or do you think we should revoke? Because you said that you'd abandoned your original reasons for supporting it, but you didn't quite say, and by the way, we should now remain in the EU.
No, well, I think, I mean, you can't deny, the biggest point for me, which the Brexiteers have, and it's a massive point, is the fact that 17.4 million people voted for it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, since then, the polls suggest that quite a number of people have changed. I think almost every poll since the referendum suggests that there's a majority for Remain. But, yeah, of course, ultimately, if there was going to be a revocation, that would need to be sanctioned by a democratic vote. And the process of getting there, I think, should be quite... I think there should be a pause now.
Yeah.
I think that if you look at the Prime Minister, she's turned into a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
I backed her deal. I thought that was the best pragmatic solution. But now that that's gone, I think... And you look at... I went to House of Commons last night, and I had strangers I'd never met coming up to me and pouring their hearts out to me. I mean, these are people at the end of their tether.
And do you think there are people like you who have changed their mind but don't feel they can say so?
Yeah, or wondering whether or not. I think because they'd seen me write this article, that's one of the reasons they were doing it. They were coming up to me and sharing their own... And it's very deep, you know, you've got your constituents, what you believe is right, you've got the Whip's office, you've got the reaction of the press, all sorts of things, you know, the financial consequences. And these are people who are talking to me, you know, I'd never met before. I mean, I went, you know, they were private conversations, but this was in the and around the House of Commons. But it really hit me about the stress people are under. And I don't think, therefore, this is a great moment to decide on the way in which we leave the European Union, because there's no agreement about it at the moment. Mm. And I'm therefore convinced, before moving on to anything else, that we need to accept President Tusk's generous offer of a 12-month pause.
But that places you then in the same bag as, take Steve Baker, one of the hardest-line Brexiteers. He now wants a long pause as well. But you aren't quite saying, I don't back Brexit and therefore I back Remain. You're sort of in a neutral territory where you want a long pause rather than calling for revocation of Article 50 or a second referendum.
I think we should entertain both the idea of revocation. Mm-hmm. I think it's preferable to no deal. I am scared of no deal. And I accept you can't revoke without a second referendum. There are masses of people who feel very, very strongly that they would be utterly betrayed if we don't leave. They have to be respected. I have changed my mind. I would have, in retrospect, I would cast my vote the other way. But we have to respect these very... There are great issues about what is a democracy and what right. You know. I do believe, however, that from what we know about the way the referendum was fought, if it had been a general election, there'd be huge questions about it, because the number of false statements made by the Brexiteers, you know, you point to Liam Fox, David Davis, easiest deal in history. We're going to have 40 deals set up by the time we leave.
Isn't that the same as any election?
I mean, yes, but if it's the same, if a party wins an election on basis of false promises,
they can get kicked out.
They get kicked out. And that is what's happened here. They won the election on the basis of false promises. And also, we're getting all kinds of evidence of impropriety, of electoral malpractice. You know, the Vote Leave accepted that it had broken election law last week, eventually, and was accepted its fine. As for the unofficial, less official campaign, I mean, isn't there a criminal investigation into it now, or something of that nature?
Right, but I mean, on this point, Peter, you're right, and it's a skullduggery, and it looks bad. But let us say, for the sake of argument, that they were guilty of spending, I think, about £300,000 more than they should have done or whatever. They would still have been outspent 2-1 by the Remain campaign, because the government was backing Remain as well as Remain. So I'm wondering if you think that the result would really have been different, given just how heavily outspent Leave was. I mean, I, any journalist ought to be appalled at any malpractice or criminality here. I've been struck by how Remain journalists are getting a lot more worried about Vote Leave's misdemeanours, and Brexit journalists like me are more inclined to say, oh, it doesn't really matter, it was a rounding error. But I'm trying to work out if you think that would have actually influenced the result.
I think there are quite a lot of questions about the way the campaign was conducted, which may have influenced. I'm very consistent here, by the way. When the Cameron won the 2015 election,
yeah,
I was pretty well the only journalist, along with Michael Crick, to call into question the illegal methods used by the Conservatives in the 2015 campaign. And I really, Michael Crick and I followed Crick. We really went, and I think it was disgraceful what was going on in the Conservative Central Office, and I really made a lot of it. So I think I'm not being inconsistent in saying that if there are questions about where the source of funds were for the non-official campaign, we want to know about that, what techniques they were using, and the methods which were being used to inflame opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that you're an enthusiast for immigration, but there were some very dark arts used on social media, which are open to question anyway.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, now and again, I ask myself what it would take me to change my mind on Brexit. I went from Remain to Leave after David Cameron's failed renegotiation because my europhilia was based on the assumption that the EU would have to reform. Mm-hmm. If it didn't reform, populism would be set Europe ablaze and the whole project would collapse. So surely they should recognise that the free movement might have made sense in the mid-90s, but no longer made sense when the demographic backdrop had completely changed. Nobody was really moving from one country to another in the mid-90s. The immigration levels across Europe were as nothing compared to what they are now. People want some basic tools to deal with this. It's not unreasonable. You have to give way. And I always thought that the EU would work out this, that David Cameron would go to the... And Merkel would think, OK, we're going to have to do this anyway, so let's just do it now and keep Britain in. When that didn't happen, I thought to myself, right, Fraser, you've been naive. Simply because you want this project to work, you think therefore it's going to work. And in fact, what we've seen is the emergence of a European Commission, Tusk and Juncker and people like that, who are, rather than member states, the member states who are responsive to electorates are no longer in control of this project. Control has gone to the Commission, which is almost prides itself in standing down democratic forces. So I always thought the democratic forces would force the EU to change eventually. And then I thought, no, Cameron's renegotiation demonstrated that was not true. And they now pride themselves in intransigence in the face of protest. And therefore, this train is heading in the wrong direction. We can jump off now and it's going to hurt because the train's still moving. But better that than follow the train to its destination. That was my fundamental calculation. Therefore, I changed my mind if, for example, there was a new European Commission coming along and it would make the reforms I asked for. It would bring back border control and believe in a Europe of nation states. If that happened, I was to say, well, if I had known this, I would have backed Remain. For you, is there anything that you think might nudge you over the line again? I mean, perhaps if we do leave and the economy doesn't turn out to be as bad as you fear.
By the way, it's more or less what you got. Again, you summarised more or less why I voted to leave in 2016. I think that probably the European Commission is going to change, actually. I think and these upcoming elections might nudge it in that direction.
So. Yeah.
And of course, I think there is something there's something in favour of changing one's mind. I think you do need to. I think, anyway, I put it in a slightly different way. To put yourself against changing your mind is to put yourself in a position where you're not looking at fresh facts and fresh arguments.
And when you're not thinking, basically.
And where you're not thinking. And if I was, I hope very much that I would love to be proved wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, if we leave, we're not going back in a hurry. We've got to make the best of it. And a lot of your democratic arguments remain true.
Mm.
And those are my arguments I entertain myself when so I agree. But I think we need to take a bit of a breather.
Well, on that, I think Brexiteers and Remainers can agree. Peter, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Fraser.